Greetings. Welcome to the Northeast Ohio AFSC Weekly Audio Podcast. I'm Greg Coleridge, Director of the Economic and Political Justice Program. As always, we hope this podcast informs you about issues you feel are important, updates you about past and upcoming AFSC plans and activities, and inspires you to take action. It is, after all, grassroots social movements made up of well-informed, prepared, and motivated people that create real change. It is Friday, March 20th, the first day of spring, and thank goodness for that. On this day, actually 1 year ago, the Bank of England in March 2014 made a startling admission. In their flagship quarterly bulletin, they admitted that in explaining the money creation process, that loans come first and then deposits follow. Here's what they said in one of the two articles explaining this money creation process. Quote, "In the modern economy, most money takes the form of bank deposits. But how those bank deposits are created is often misunderstood. The principal way in which they are created is through commercial banks making loans. Whenever a bank makes a loan, it creates a deposit in the borrower's bank account, thereby creating new money," unquote. Well, you know, people on the left, people on the right, people who are considered crazies have been for a long time talking about, no, the banks create money out of nothing, out of thin air, and at interest that has to be paid back. It's a debt. And finally, for the first time, you got the Bank of England a year ago making that very admission, confirming what people at the grassroots have been saying all along, that this power to create money should not be in the hands of banks. It should be in the hands of government, and that banks should only be able to loan out money they already have in their reserves, period. That's what various pieces of legislation around the world, including here in the United States, as represented by the NEED Act that was introduced in the last couple of Congresses, is all about. Well, turning now to report of events that we participated in last week, and there's a couple of them worth mentioning. The first was last Saturday, March 14th, at the Peace House where the Cleveland Friends meeting meets in University Circle, a meeting of individuals who are looking to plan an event that would be entitled, quote, "What the Bleep Happened to Hip Hop?" That is, in fact, a national public education campaign occurring everywhere to address the corporatization of music, dance, and other art forms, and try, anyway, to shine a critical lens on issues of race, class, and gender in our contemporary American culture. What the Bleep Happened to Hip Hop is a national joint project between Move to Amend and a group called Hip Hop Congress, made up largely of young people who are trying to recapture that genre and return it to being a means, an artistic way of communicating social concerns and advocating for social change. So individuals came together, were looking to plan a one-day public program and performance event sometime this summer, looking to be probably in July in Cleveland. There's already been, I don't know, I think about a dozen of these held around the country and many more to come. And more information about this upcoming summer event in future podcasts. That was Saturday. On Tuesday of this past week in Talmadge was a meeting of people looking to try to get on the ballot a Move to Amend initiative that met at the public library on 90 Community Road. A good group of people, very committed, good energy, looking to have a film showing of the Move to Amend film Legalize Democracy on April the 9th. And based on that, we'll determine to what degree people want to try to pursue trying to get something through council, trying to get council to put something on the ballot, or whether citizens themselves in Talmadge will go about the citizen initiative process. and get something on the ballot, probably looking to be in 2016, using the entire 2015 summer and fall and November election to gather signatures and do community education, and then use all of 2016 to do the same. So that's what happened on Tuesday and what is upcoming on April the 9th, which I believe is a Thursday evening. Yes, it is at 6:30. That will take place at the Talmadge Public Library. There again, 90 Community Road in Talmadge. Thursday, that would have been last evening, we showed a film called The Story of Citizens United versus FEC, a very short film. Put together by Annie Leonard, who created The Story of Stuff, and that was held at the Berea Public Library, sponsored by the newly established group Berea Move to Amend. Good short film, so it does provide opportunities to discuss and dialogue about the issues, and used it as a springboard then to talk about what people there in Berea wanted to do. And much like Talmadge, there is interest in using all of 2015 to do education and petition gathering, and use the several summer events to table and to flag people down who are out and about, concentrated there in town. And also when students reconvene at Baldwin Wallace, which is located in Berea, to try to involve them. There were several professors at the meeting, several of whom were strongly committed to spreading the word on campus. So it's looking like this will be a very nice town and gown, if you will, joint effort to get this measure both spread around educationally, but also to gather signatures for, again, a November 2016 ballot effort. There are also some people there who were from the local North Royalton, anyway, UU Church, several of whom live in Berea, and a UCC church, and names were thrown around of people in the Presbyterian Church locally and others. So I think it's going to be a nice little crowd of people who will be working on this effort there. So those were the events that took place this past week. Turning now to events and activities for next week, beginning tomorrow, the 21st, on Saturday, in Chagrin Falls. The mayor and council will be hosting a democracy public hearing that will take place beginning at 1 p.m. at the Village Hall in Chagrin Falls on West Washington Street. It will involve citizens who will be invited to share their views on the impact to the community, the state, and the nation from the political influence of corporate entities and big money. All of this sprung from the Patriots for Change successful citizen initiative that got on the ballot this past November and passed with a whopping 67% of the vote. So citizens will be invited to comment and reflect upon the impact of corporate influence and big money on their own community, their own lives, and the larger state and nation. It's open to all, so feel free to attend that meeting in Chagrin Falls, March 21st, 1 p.m. at the Village Hall. March 27th, or I should say 6th and 7th, that's next Thursday and Friday, will be a two-day free training of something called Theater of the Oppressed. AFSC has been working on organizing this for the past several months, along with several co-sponsors, including the Unitarian Universalist Church of Akron, their social action committee, the Alternatives to Violence program in Akron, and the National Pedagogy and Theater of the Oppressed project, the head of which is a resident of Kent. and is going to be facilitating and leading this two-day training. Theater of the Oppressed is a mechanism or a means or a tool to use theater for social action, to examine structural oppression, to collectively propose solutions, and to activate bottom-up change. It has been used by community-based organizations and individuals using a series of theater-based activities to examine and overcome oppression the world over. Audiences get actively involved and suggest actions and ideas, which leads to concrete actions that can change their communities, schools, organizations, or the larger macro community. So that two-day training is coming up this Thursday and this Friday. It will be held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Akron, of Akron, which is located at 3300 Moorwood Road, just off West Market Street, across from the Summit Mall. It begins Thursday from 9, running until 4 or 5, and again Friday, beginning at 9 and ending at 4. At 3 p.m. on Friday, there will be sort of a public performance, demonstration, where the actual plays or actions will be presented. And that's open to anyone. So whether you are interested in actually participating in the 1 or 2 days, and it should be emphasized that the training, while it is being publicized as 2 days, if you're only able to attend one, that is perfectly fine, either one. The first day deals with sort of the description and the foundation, and the second day is sort of the development of the Theater of the Oppressed techniques for specific social issues. So to RSVP, we're up to about 35 people or so, but there still is room if you're interested or you want more information. Email AFSC Workshops, that's one word, afscworkshops@gmail.com, or call our office 330-928-2301. So that's next Thursday and Friday. The following day, a week from tomorrow, Saturday, is also a very busy day that we have been very involved in planning for many months with others around the state. It is the third annual statewide gathering of the Move to Amend Ohio Network that will take place from 10 to 4 at the First Unitarian Universalist Church on Weisheimer Road in Columbus. Caitlin Sopoki Belknap, who is the Move to Amend National Director, will be there, and there will also be opportunities to just hear about and discuss national Move to Amend plans and activities. There'll be various breakout sessions on Move to Amend related issues and organizing skills. There'll be a business portion of the meeting where we will be entertaining and debating and discussing proposals for what the statewide network should be doing going forward. There'll be a report on what's going on this past year and how we can reach out to new communities, not just geographic, but gender and race and age, and expand the diversity of the growing Move to Amend movement in Ohio, and doing our part to expand that across the country, and participate in discussion on organizing. We're going to explore what it would take to launch a statewide ballot initiative by 2020, and many other things taking place. If you're interested, certainly anyone is invited to attend, to participate, to learn more. If you have any questions or would like more information, you can call our office, 330-928-2301. Or for the full agenda of the event itself, please go to the website, movetoamend.org/Ohio. So if you go there, movetoamend.org/Ohio, And under the announcements, the first, second, or third one, there's a couple of them, actually, that lay out what all is going to be taking place on the 28th of March. There'll be carpools from the Cleveland area and some people, I think, coming from Kent, Talmadge. I think maybe somebody coming from Stowe. So some people coming from Summit County area as well, if you want to try to hook up. Well, so those are the events that we're working on for this next week. We now comment on several news items that warrant attention and possible action, either individually or with others. Beginning with an article that we ran into that I think is very interesting and very current in that it connects the past and maybe some lessons that can be learned from the past for the current situation that we face. In particular, the issue has to do with realities, 10 of which would show we are much worse off now today than we were as a country just before the last economic crisis, which I believe foretells that another economic crisis, very sad to say, is soon coming. These are the warning signals, if you will, a canary in the mine of what we can learn about what happened before. So comparing the situation just before the last economic crisis today to today, here's sort of 10 realities. Number one, the national debt has increased, is worse today than then. It was more than $1 trillion in 2014 alone has been added to the national debt. It now totals $18 trillion. It wasn't anywhere that size prior to the last economic crisis. Number two, the total debt in our country, both public and private, has increased. In 1975, the total debt was, quote-unquote, just $2.5 trillion. It rose to $50 trillion just prior to the last recession, and now it's nearly $60 trillion today. Number three, the velocity of money. By velocity, we mean the circulation. How many times does a dollar, let's say, circulate in a community before it stops dead in its tracks? And there's research and ways of measuring that federally. Well, that velocity of money has decreased. It's the lowest level it has been in the last at least 55 years, certainly much lower than it was prior to the last economic crisis. Number four, homeownership rates have been seeing a steady decline, and that's with interest rates being really at historic low levels. They're virtually at zero from the Federal Reserve under their zero interest rate policy, or ZIRP, Z-I-R-P. And for homeowners who are trying to get a loan, those rates have been historically low, yet homeownership rates have still been going down. So what does that say if and when the Fed reverses course, as they're threatening to do? I doubt whether they're actually going to do it, because the whole economy would implode by raising rates, even if it's a quarter of 1%. But if and when that happens and loan rates go up for mortgages, do you think that's going to increase the ability of individuals to buy homes? Highly unlikely. Number five, the unemployment rate. While it has recently improved to finally rise to levels above the depth of the recession, you know, many believe that those numbers are not altogether legitimate, since they have been redefined based on who's counted and how many jobs are counted and the like. But nevertheless, employment is about what it was at the depths of the Great Recession of a couple of years ago. It's a little bit better now, but given that we're 6 years at supposedly the end of the recession, to have unemployment figures just barely rise or fall to below levels, to above levels of the recession, maybe isn't saying a whole lot. Number six, the labor force participation rate is falling. Labor force participation are people who are actually employable in the labor force as a percentage of the population. It's well below recession levels and have been rapidly declining this percentage. So what that means is you've got more people now who potentially are employable who aren't working, who aren't in the labor force, and thus aren't even counted more than ever. And certainly much greater numbers of people and much greater percentage of people who are in that labor force participation or unparticipation rate. Number seven, the inactivity rate for men in their prime working years has risen from 9% just before the last recession to now 12%. So you've got people who, guys in particular, men who bring in more money, it shouldn't be this way, but it still is, bring in more money than women into their households who are inactive economically in their prime working years. Eight, real median income, household income, has declined. This, of course, is connected to fewer people in the labor force and stagnant wages. If you just sort of look at basic numbers, 39% of American workers make less than $20,000 a year, 52% make less than $30,000 a year, 63% make less than $40,000 a year. If you are the only worker and you're in a household with a family of a couple kids, making 20, 30, 40 grand just doesn't cut it. Median household income has declined and is certainly worse than it was prior to the last recession. And lastly, food stamp spending is up. The federal government now spends about twice as much on food stamps as it was just prior to the last recession. What does that say about a reality in which we are told virtually every day that, well, the recession is over, things are upturning. 6 years after the end of the supposed recession, here's all that is economically so grand. Well, I believe it's actually an illusion and propaganda. Yes, the stock market has soared, but that doesn't benefit the average person. The economy is actually perverted. That is dominated by the financialization. The real economy of companies producing real goods and services has taken a backseat to the casino economy, where banks are buying up companies, taking them apart, or just trying to use them to get short-term gains. And, of course, the export of production continues and the decline of real wages and all of these other realities paint a very grim picture that will result inevitably in a much more serious economic crisis in the not-too-distant future unless we pivot and make some changes spending-wise, tax-wise, and monetary-wise. Hopefully that can happen. Well, the second issue has to do with the budget. This week, at the federal level, the Republicans introduced their own federal budget proposal for this year. The president earlier, a month ago, or about 2 months ago, introduced his budget. And the Republican budget is a draconian budget proposal that would cut significantly Medicare, defund the Affordable Care Act, and make very significant cuts to many domestic programs such as food stamps, education, the environment, housing, and others. These proposals are not all that different than earlier proposals in previous years. However, since the Republicans now control both houses of Congress, they might actually pass. Their budget would, it should, at the other side of the equation, the reality is that it also calls for increasing spending to the Pentagon slush fund that pays for the Afghanistan war and the war on ISIS, which is basically not going anywhere and won't go anywhere because you can't address a non-military problem with military solutions, and that's what the military is doing yet again. Anyway, along with the Republicans introducing their budget proposal, the Congressional Progressive Caucus introduced theirs also this week, called the People's Budget, A Raise for America. And it, in many regards, is the polar opposite of the Republicans' budget proposal. What it contains is proposals that would create 8.4 million good-paying jobs by 2018. It calls for investing $1.9 trillion in America's future and puts $820 billion toward infrastructure and transportation improvements. It cuts waste from the base military budget, eliminates the Pentagon's overseas contingency operations slush fund, ends the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan after 2016, cuts unnecessary spending on destabilizing nuclear weapons, requires that the Pentagon be audited, and invests in diplomacy. It also provides a new framework to transition workers in military industries to good jobs in the civilian sector. And this description of the people's budget comes from Cole Harrison, who is the National Peace Actions Move the Money Working Group convener. The peace budget would bring in revenue and redress extreme inequality by closing corporate tax loopholes and by a progressive tax on incomes over $1 million a year. And finally, it takes on the climate crisis by imposing a carbon tax as well as funding transportation improvements, particularly public transportation improvements. So if you feel that this progressive caucus budget is a bit more sane and humane than the Republican proposed federal budget proposal, you are kindly asked to call your senators and your congressperson and let them know that you support their vote for the congressional progressive caucus. Both budgets are likely to be heard and some kind of vote as early as next week. So you can reach the U.S. Capitol switchboard by calling 202-224-3121. Get a hold of Senators Brown and Portman and your congressperson, whoever that may be, whether you're hearing this and you live in Northeast Ohio or elsewhere in the state. Hopefully you know who that is. Call your congressperson. Make those three calls by calling the Capitol switchboard. Again, that number is 202-224-3121. All right, thirdly, there was an article this past week about the administration sponsoring a classified briefing with Congress on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. A briefing was held this past Wednesday between members of Congress and the U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman and staff at the U.S. Labor Department, which provided details on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or the TPP, which is the so-called and, I think, horrifically misnamed trade pact, so-called trade pact, between the U.S. and 12 Latin American and Asian countries. The briefing wasn't just a normal meeting, however. It was labeled classified, meaning that lawmakers, those congresspersons in attendance and any of their aides who attended, were barred under threat of punishment from revealing what they may have learned from that briefing with constituents or with any outside experts. The meeting focused on the section of the TPP that deals with the controversial, what's called investor-state dispute settlement process, or ISDS, which we have mentioned before in previous podcasts, which would establish how disputes over so-called trade barriers under the proposed agreement would be resolved. The negotiations have been conducted in secret to the public, that is. Representatives from about 600 transnational corporations have been consultants to the negotiations from day one. Members of the U.S. Congress, however, for the most part, have also been kept in the dark. It's not just the public, but also those we elect to represent us who go and deliberate and meet in Congress have been, for the most part, shut out in knowing what is contained in this so-called trade deal. The ISDS calls for establishing a so-called tribunal that would serve the function of a court, which would adjudicate disputes. The disputes could be between two nations or between a nation state and a corporation. what a nation state calls a democratically enacted labor law, consumer law, or environmental law, the corporation could call a barrier to trade, to allow goods or services it produces from entering their market. It is an anti-democratic travesty. This TPP and others like it that contain this provision, this ISDS, which it should be said, NAFTA has it, and certainly it has been used in ways that have trumped and corrupted democracy. And ISDS in the TPP and the European equivalent would be only worse, in that it now allows a corporation to sue a nation state directly. They don't have to have a nation state to be their surrogate. They can directly come before this tribunal and challenge a democratically enacted labor, consumer, or environmental law. The unelected tribunal, composed of corporate-friendly members, would only rule on the question of whether the democratically enacted laws are barriers to trade, not whether they promote worker justice, consumer safety, environmental sustainability, or national sovereignty. The ISDS would trump national democratic self-governance. It's no wonder the Obama administration and its pro-corporate allies in the House and Senate who support the TPP haven't come clean about this provision and others. Representative Lloyd Doggett from Texas condemned the classified briefing. He said, quote, "Making it classified further ensures that even if we accidentally learn something, we cannot share it. What is Froman working so hard to hide? What is the specific legal basis for all this senseless security? Open trade should begin with open access. Members expected to vote on trade deals should be able to read the unredacted negotiating text," unquote. Said Representative Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut, quote, "If the TPP would be as good for American jobs as they claim, there should be nothing to hide," unquote. Critics of the administration assert that applying national security-style limits on such information is, in fact, an abuse of the whole classified information system. You know, that system or that use of having something classified should be reserved from, you know, to information or documents on how to make nuclear weapons or how to or not revealing CIA spies in foreign nations or something else, but not about something related to trade negotiations. It's not about trying to prevent other nations from knowing what's in the proposed agreement, since the negotiations are with representatives of those foreign nations. So it's ridiculous. The super secrecy is designed for one purpose and one purpose alone, and that's to keep the details of this anti-democratic deal out of the public and media spotlight for as long as possible. The TPP, as we have said in other podcasts before, and will continue to say, is not about, in the end, trade at all, be it free trade or fair trade. It's mostly about democracy, about who rules, who decides. Will it be we the people through our elected representatives? And we're having a difficult time enough, virtually an impossible time, to have any amount of realistic self-determination and democracy at the nation-state level. But still, we've got a much better shot to have something resembling democracy at a nation-state level than at an international level, where corporations can use the shield of trade barriers to overrule national rules for increased power and profit through these ridiculous and kangaroo court-type tribunals. That's what this deal is all about. The TPP and the fast-track negotiating authority, which allows the administration to ram the TPP through Congress with minimum debate and no amendments, come up for a vote soon. If you haven't already contacted your senators and congressperson, now's the time. Even if you have previously, now's the time to do so again. Fast Track and the TPP are about increasing corporate rule and rights, not about democracy, justice, safety, or sustainability. So please consider using that same number, Capital Switchboard. Give your congressperson, your senators, a call at 202-224-3121. Weigh in. Say you're against the TPP and against Fast Track and against any effort that would reduce our ability to govern ourselves. Well, the fourth item, a survey that came up, a poll actually, according to a recent Associated Press poll, over two-thirds of Americans, that is in fact 68%, feel the nation's wealthy pay too little in federal taxes. Only 11% feel the wealthy pay too much. Bernie Sanders, kind of commenting on this whole issue of inequality, said, quote, "The real struggle is whether we can prevent this country from moving to an oligarchic form of society in which virtually all economic and political power rests with a handful of billionaires," unquote. So this very notion of two-thirds of Americans feeling that the nation's wealthy pay too little, that they should pay more, but yet we not having public policies or suggestions that are serious, that have a realistic chance of passing, is just one more illustration of the disconnect between what people want, in this case, by an overwhelming. You know, if a person is elected with 68%, you say they have a massive mandate to do whatever it is they claim they wanted to do and that they campaigned to do. Yet here you have 68% of Americans saying they want the wealthy to pay more in taxes, but yet there isn't any chance that that is going to happen by itself, on its own, by those we elect, through any of these proposals that are being put forth that have any kind of serious chance of passing, unless we at the local level, at the grassroots level, apply incredible pressure. And that involves, yes, in part, making calls, whether it's on the budget, whether it's on the TPP, whether it's on this, but also complementing and supplementing that with mass actions, with getting out on the street, with showing up in congressional offices, with resistance. And that needs to happen as well. So just one more illustration of how there is this disconnect. And quite honestly, even with making the calls and even with mass action, unless we change the fundamental rules of the game, unless we focus on changing the Constitution that permits wealthy individuals from having the kind of political power they have and using their monetary power to drown out the voices, as they do, since money is speech, we're not going to be significantly heard. So the only way we can be heard is, yeah, we have to make calls for what little that's worth, and yes, we have to do mass action, but we also have to apply and work at not just applying pressure on these individual issues, but also applying pressure and doing mass actions and doing organizing at trying to change the fundamental ground rules. Well, lastly, a report that just came to my attention that came out a number of months ago called Fixed Fortunes by the Sunlight Foundation that showed between 2007 and 2008, 200 of America's most politically active corporations spent a combined $5.8 billion on federal lobbying and campaign contributions. This was a year-long analysis by the foundation Sunlight, and what it showed is that what corporations got, these 200 of the most politically active ones, for their $5.8 billion was $4.4 trillion in federal business and support. 5 years ago, the Supreme Court in Citizens United suggested the answer to the question of whether corporations have got too much power and the like is no, they didn't. You know, they said corporate spending to influence federal elections would not, quote, give rise to corruption or the appearance of corruption, unquote. Seriously, that's what they said, the majority in the Citizens United decision, that corporate spending to influence federal elections would not give rise to corruption or even the appearance of corruption. Yet this Sunlight Foundation is just the latest in a very, very long list of documentation that shows how completely absurd and out to lunch and completely divorced from reality the majority of the Supreme Court was and remains following the Citizens United decision. Of course, corporate entities have political influence, and here, as documented in this report, is the case. Sunlight focused on the records of 200 for-profit corporations, all of which had active political action committees and lobbyists in 2008, 10, and 12 election cycles. After examining 14 million records, including data on campaign contributions, lobbying, federal budget allocations, and spending, they found that on average, for every $1 spent on influencing politics, the nation's most politically active corporations received $760 from the government. Think about that. For every $1 they spent or invested, however you want to look at it, they got back $760 from the government. You and I aren't able to receive more than, what, a 0.25% return from our investments if we put our money into a bank. Investments in the stock market, which is on this, you know, crazy historic run over the past couple of years, has been, what, 10 to 20%? Yet these returns are laughable compared to the political investments of these 200 corporations, which amounts to, in percentage terms, 75,900%. This pay-to-play, or maybe more appropriate, pay-to-profit political system shifts tax dollars from our coats to corporate coffers. And it will continue to happen if all we do is simply expose the problem or call for Band-Aid solutions. So long as corporations possess the inalienable constitutional rights to donate or invest in politics and politicians, this will continue to happen forever and ever and ever and ever, as it has been happening. It's time to work for a big solution to solve this big problem, which is a constitutional amendment to end corporate personhood and money of speech. Well, that's all for this week. Keep up with our activities. Contact us with questions, concerns, or willingness to help out. Our website is afsc.org/Akron. Facebook page is facebook.com/NEOAFSC. Our program blog is northeastohio.wordpress.com. My blog is createworlddemocracy.wordpress.com. Until next week, onward for justice, peace, and democracy.